So this week, we're going to talk about the eternal light. We're in Parshat Tzav. So the everyone knows, or I imagine you know, that in the main sanctuary, there's a giant sort of metal thing hanging over the ark, and there's a tiny little light in it that's called an eternal light. We're going to find out exactly what it means or what it may mean today. We'll spend some time looking at it. And in the last 15 minutes or so, the reason why I brought the computer, we're going to look at some, I found some pictures of Ner Tamid, and we're going to venture into an area that's well outside my comfort zone and try to comment on some art. But, you know, it's good to, it's another form of Jewish expression, and so we'll spend some time trying to see what it evokes in us. So we're in Parshat Tzav. Last week we began the book of Leviticus. We're still going through the laws of priesthood and sacrifice. It can be a little dry, but I wanted to focus just on two verses, verse 5 and 6. Does someone feel comfortable to read in English in the, where it says NJ? We're on the front page of the packet where it says NJPS there. Sorry. Thanks, Herschel. It's just where, yeah, just where the little 5 comes up at the period there.
Okay.
Sorry.
The fire on the altar shall be kept burning, not to go out. Every morning the priest shall feed wood to it, lay out the burnt offering on it, and turn into smoke the fat parts of the offering, well being.
The
perpetual fire shall be kept burning on the altar, not to go out.
Okay, so let's put on our sort of critical glasses. Is there anything that jumps out at us from these two verses? Surprising, confusing, interesting.
Well, it's more than just the fire, it's the offering as well.
What do you mean? What is it in your sentence?
The fire should be kept burning, but lay the burnt offering on it.
Right, so the altar, so there is a thing called the burnt offering, which is, we talked about it for like a second last week. One of the innovations of the Israelite people was that one offering was burnt entirely. Was there? You didn't eat any of it. It was offered entirely to God, and they say that gets offered on this altar in the morning, and it's on an altar that's always burning. Like you're never allowed to put the fire of the altar out. Okay, Herschel, 1, 2, 3. Yeah.
I was going to say because the fire is never put out, you're always
Thank you.
In sacrifice and giving something to God, even if it's not necessarily an animal.
Excellent. So there's an implication for post-sacrificial times that we're supposed to always be ready to sacrifice. Interesting. Yes.
I have a lot of problems with sacrificing
Good.
And burning.
Yeah.
First of all, killing something that was created by God. So we are killing that creation. And also, I don't think that in the old days we had that much to eat. So they found the purest kind of animal. I know this is a very primitive question, but it has been really bugging me. They get a very pure, clean animal, kill it, and bring it to the end. I mean, they don't feed hungry people. What is that?
So this was my sermon last week. Yeah, it's online for sure. You can. I don't know if it's online now, but it will be. Yeah, last Saturday's sermon, but I can give you the Cliff Notes version, which is the reason why we have sacrifice at all. The rabbis debate for as long as we haven't had sacrifice in the Jewish religion for 2,000 years. Yet it's a huge chunk of the Torah. So the rabbis have spent a long time, and they're split into two camps of people who want the sacrifices to come back eventually, that it's a higher form of worship, and people who felt that it was a stepping stone to what we have now, more abstract prayer. And the reasons are, like the pro reasons are, it's really physical and tangible, it's related to our life. It is the con reasons are, that's what they needed then. What God did was take away human sacrifice, and that was the big change. That's what they were ready to do, and now we're ready to move to a more abstract kind of prayer. There's a Yiddish word called a chap, which is your grasp, your insight into what it is. And my chap on it was that I think all of Leviticus is a treatise on ritual in general. That God never tells us explicitly why, but God sets up the rules and the order and the way you do it in intricate detail because it's those frameworks that give us the ability to bring our own meaning or learn the meaning of our friends or to build together to make a new meaning inside of another framework. So yes, I'm glad we got away from sacrifice eventually, personally, but that's where we are. So one and then two.
Yeah, about the sacrifice.
Yeah.
You already mentioned, the rabbi mentioned that this is what it was at those times. This is what they were familiar with, you know, and God did not, I'm sure, did not want to take them completely out of what is familiar. You know, this is a new nation. And they see sacrifices going on all around them. This is what everybody else did. But they did it, even the other people, the other nations did it worse, because they sacrificed their kids. This is animals, sacrificing animals. So this is something familiar to them at that time. It's the same thing with the Jews when they wanted a king. Why did they want a king? They got God. Because it was familiar, they're looking around and they see all the other nations have kings, so we want a king too. It's what was established at that time.
I see that, and I know this is one step forward. You know, instead of killing people, probably the most beautiful people to be buried over there. But at least give it to, don't burn it to the end. Like,
so, 100%. I mean, they're real. That's not what I want to focus on today, but there are real questions. One and then two.
Well, she and didn't use a word. I would add only a word to what this lady just said. They came out of a pagan ritual.
Yeah.
And God or whomever knew you couldn't turn the whole thing over in one night. They kept as much of it as they could so they wouldn't have too many defectors. The other question I'd like to ask is, I wrote it down before we began. You just said this, if I got you correctly, that Leviticus is filled with ritual, the priests, and the... How many times is the word abomination used in the Torah with one sentence? And here we have tons of words about how do you dress, how do you build anything.
How many times is Toivah used?
The word abomination is not used. And it's only used in very simple, singular sentences. Thou shalt not be gay, or thou shalt not...
I don't know. I'd have to use a concordance to find out.
A ton of words over how to dress.
That's true.
Is this more important than these rules that we hear about today, that you should not commit abominations? You should not lie with animals, you should not lie with a man?
I don't know about more or less important. I do think that they're different categories.
Heavy weight. Leviticus is a lot of words.
That's true. Leviticus is also where you find those rules you're talking about. So that's in the same book. So 100%. I do think that when we get into the sacrificial rules, that God is describing what Jewish religion would have been like then. God, or whoever the writer of it, is telling us this is how they went to synagogue, this is what they did. This is the categories of things. Let's keep going. I like to hear from people.
I don't know if anybody said this, but first of all, the wood, aren't they in the desert when this is given?
Great. So there seems to be no end of the resources they're able to get in the desert. And so there are basically three ways to read that. One is that God, it's like God planned it out and that's how it's happening. Two is that desert's actually not a great translation. It's the wilderness,
okay,
as opposed to the desert. So there may have been some sort of material wealth about. And the third, which I think probably makes the most sense to me personally, is that yes, they were in the wilderness, but they were also more or less along a trade route. So there were people going back and forth. No one lived there, but there would have been caravans occasionally going back and forth to get stuff.
Then I have another question, which
okay.
is that I understand in my rationalization for keeping the fire burning all the time is that it was cooking food, essentially, even though uh-huh. I know it's supposed to be for altars, but that fed the priest. But what about manna? And then also, what about Shabbat? So does that mean the fire is burning on Shabbat?
Yes, so all of the rules of Shabbat don't apply to the temple. All of the things you can't do on Shabbat don't. In fact, it's often they're connected. It's on purpose, actually. The things you do in the temple are the things you're not allowed to do on Shabbat, sort of. It's like rabbinic. So like that's what they say it is, but there's lots of contradictions that prove that's not the case. But hypothetically, that's what they're going for. But it's a very good point. And also that you're pointing towards where a very close reading, which when you say the cooking, is that they didn't have matches or lighters or ovens at the times. That keeping the oven burning was just an easier way of having a fire going. That's what people did. And that's how they kept your fire going. So you didn't have to always get the flint and steel, if you even had that, or whatever, the little Boy Scout bow thing to make fire. You had to keep In fact, many times, the way what we translate as fire often could mean hot coal or something like that. That's an interchangeable word in the Bible. Great. There were some more hands over here. I forget who. Yes. Right, so I haven't yet gone into any of the who wrote the Bible kinds of questions in our class, so. No, those are, that's the, I didn't explain that either, so I'll do both of those. So NJPS and OJPS means New Jewish Publication Society and Old Jewish Publication Society. That around 1918, the JPS put out a translation of the Bible, and that's the old JPS translation. And they finished it. It took them about 15 years to do the whole Tanakh, but the Torah was in the late 60s, is the New Jewish Publication Society translation. And it's basically, it's getting rid of thou, for the most part. Old JPS is a little closer to word-by-word translation, and NJPS is less interested in word-by-word and more interested in getting the feel of the whole sentence as a tool of translation. Generally speaking, that's what that is about. So when we talk about who wrote the Bible, I'll give you my two-minute one, and maybe I'll pick a Thursday and we'll spend real time on just that question. For me, in the short run, it doesn't actually matter for me who wrote the Bible. We clearly have fault lines in the way the Bible is written. It could have been done by people, or I see no reason why God couldn't have written a Bible that shows different styles of writing. Now, for sure, one of those camps of tradition that we find throughout the Bible is the priestly tradition, and it is concerned with three things. Establishment of the power of the priesthood. The priesthood is like the ones who should rule. Two is they are real detail-oriented people. These are the, like, anytime you get a story, the begat, 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 or like, at this time, at this date, at this place, this is what happened, that's when you're in the priestly section. And the third is establishing like priestly lineage of like where that for all times priests are the ones who are supposed to be in charge. And so that I think for most of Leviticus you can read it that way. There are parts that certainly venture from that vein, but for sure there is that writing style is consistent over a bunch of different ones. What I think you were pointing out when you saw NJPS is that the documentary hypothesis, which comes around the turn of the previous century, around the early 1900s, is that there were four general sources for the writing of the Bible, J, E, P, and D. The Jahwist is that when you see Adonai as the name, E is the Elohist, who when you see Elohim as the name of God used, P is the priestly source, and D is the Deuteronomic, whatever, you get the idea. Deuteronomic, that's what I was there. Well, don't worry about it. So in recent times, even that's been basically blown out of the water, that modern scholars think that even that's a little silly, that there is clearly a priestly source, but the other ones, we're holding on to too much. Like, we're trying to put two things together that don't just, and really we've got a wide variety of traditions that have been smushed together into our one Bible. Again, I see no reason why that has to be by people over time versus God at one time. But what matters to me is that it becomes the foundation for actually really all of Western civilization. Not even just, we call it Judeo-Christian, but also the Muslims consider the Old Testament the foundation for their Quran. They think that reading that is good as well. So really, you know, something like half the world's population, their values are founded in the First Testament. All right. I'm assuming you're going to tell me why I'm wrong about something. You're not this time. Okay.
Two questions.
Yeah.
Which is the role of the Sanhedrin in this situation? And then I'm curious how you introduce this to young kids.
Ah. So two very different questions. So the role of the Sanhedrin. First, we have no historical evidence that the Sanhedrin is the name of the great rabbinic court of 70 rabbis who were to preside over religious rulings. We have no evidence that a Sanhedrin ever actually existed. We have no historical evidence that other than internal, that like Mishnah and Talmud reference it on occasion, but we have no evidence that it ever really existed. But according to Pirkei Avot, they are one step in the transmission process. What we want to do with that is that that's almost entirely true. The truth is we do have evidence of one Sanhedrin existing about 200 years ago. Napoleon convened a Sanhedrin of French Jews. He wanted them to declare themselves French instead of Jewish. but that's probably not what you meant. But that being said, it doesn't mean it didn't exist. We just have no clear evidence of when, or because the idea of rabbi didn't really develop until around the year zero, give or take. So when this Sanhedrin court existed is a little unclear. The second question, how do you teach this to kids? I am constantly figuring this out because I am teaching it to kids, is I usually try and talk about the difference between science and religion, and that both are asking different questions. And most kids have some sort of science. I'll say, what's your job in science? What are you supposed to do? And they say, we're supposed to measure, we're supposed to take data, we're supposed to come to a conclusion, we're supposed to get the facts. And I'll say, okay, that's great. And when you come to religion, what's our job? What are we trying to do? And most of the time they can get to, we're trying to be better people, we're trying to build a connection with God, we're trying to relate to other Jews. They don't use those words, of course, but more or less what they can do. And so from that point of view, science's job, or the academy's job, is to figure out who wrote the Bible and to like lay out these fault lines of different textual traditions. But our job, when we come to religious school, when we talk to the rabbi, when we do Jewish religion, is to figure out what it all means and how we relate to our lives and how it builds a value source. So I say, maybe it was written by people, maybe it was written by God. Either way, I know it's the foundation of our religion and our people, and so we get to learn from it, from that.
I was just really asking with more specificity as it relates to Deuteronomy.
As it relates to Deuteronomy?
Specifically.
How do I teach, like, sacrifices to kids? I usually don't, to be perfectly honest. The older kids, when we get into it, I talk about the different meanings of giving of yourself. Most kids, I spend a little bit of time with, like, korban means lekarev, like to come close to God. And there are some nice starting points for that. But for the most part, I just, like, there's so much Bible to teach and so little time to teach it. I mentioned there were sacrifices. I might talk about a stepping stone argument, like we've been talking about here, that it's the next step towards prayer. But I, for the most part, avoid talking about sacrifices with kids.
How do you get past the Akedah?
That I don't try and get past. we're really pretty far afield at the moment. But my short answer to that is we read it together because I love this text of the Akedah. Is especially once you hit around fifth grade, the text itself is enormously contradictory and confusing, and all the things we think we know about the Akedah is actually not at all clear. And the second is I open up the idea of, I think Abraham failed his test. In the short, that Abraham has one conversation with Isaac. His entire life as a father and son, they have one conversation in the whole Bible, and it's when Isaac's carrying the wood and the fire and the knife up the mountain and says, hey, Dad, what's going on here? What are we doing? And Abraham says, don't worry about it. Never talk before or after. I think that God... the test that Abraham was, just like Abraham stood up for Sodom and Gomorrah a chapter earlier, I would have liked to see Abraham stand up to God and say, no, I'm not going to do that right now. But another conversation for another time. Back to the eternal light. Ner Tamid. So it is anyway clear that we have to have a fire continually burning here, and that it's actually a debate whether or not this is the source for eternal light. You're also supposed to have the menorah eternally burning, that seven-branched candelabra. So maybe that's really the source of the Ner Tamid. But regardless, the temple seems to involve a bunch of fire that keeps burning. Yes? Right, so it'll be hard to start a fire. A great segue. I wanted to get back to there. Let's turn to page 2. page 4. I wrote number 2 next to it because I wanted to do it in a second. Here we have Rashi. So again, this is a good Rashi comment to understand what Rashi does in general. Rashi is doing exactly what Fran was just doing, which is to say, I don't care necessarily what the Torah means. I don't know what it means to me. I want to know what it says. When it repeats itself, what is it saying when it says that? Where are people actually standing? Let's lay it out and make it more clear, because the Torah is written in very terse language with as few words as possible, and it's often hard to follow. I'm going to tell you what's going on. So Rashi says, the fire on the altar shall be kept burning. The repetition of this instruction in verses 2, 5, and 6 is discussed in Tractate Yoma, where our sages differ on how many different fires were kept burning atop the altar. So, number one, he points out the fact that the Torah doesn't need to say over and over again, kept burning. I didn't show you verse 2, but it said there we kept burning. In 5, it says we keep it burning. And in verse 6, it says the fire shall be kept burning forever, or eternally. It's confusing and contradictory. So then in bold, that means it's a quote from the text, lay out the burnt offering on it. That is, the regular daily offering is laid out first. In other words, Rashi is saying, when our Torah says, lay out the burnt offering on it, what that means is, the Torah is telling us that the first offering of the day was the daily offering, and it was laid out first, to be burned first. The fat parts of the offering of well-being, that is, if any offerings of well-being are brought. Since this is not necessarily so, the sages understand that our verse says the offerings of well-being to permit hashlamim to be read as hashlamam, complete them. Thus, all other offerings must be completed on top of the morning offering, leaving the regular afternoon offering as the last one of the day. In other words, Rashi is pointing out a problem. We say we burn the fats of the shlamim offering, but Rashi is pointing out that, in fact, you don't have to offer the shlamim all the time. That's an offering of free will. That's a when you feel like you are moved to bring an offering, that's what you do. And so he says that our rabbis earlier said you can actually change the way you read the Bible. And instead of saying hashlamim, which has the implication of there always being this offering, you can read hashlamam, which means when it's available, like those offerings when they're there, basically. Yes. Yeah.
And when it says v'hiktir aleha helbe hashlamim, is that like, what is that?
The fat of the shlamim offering.
Oh, and what is the shlamim?
The Rashi is telling us it is the free will offering.
Anything could be solid.
Yeah, what is it specifically? It's meat. Sorry.
Also meat.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. Thank you. I didn't follow that. And we'll keep going, a perpetual fire, and it is from this fire that is described as burning continually that the lampstand which burns continually is to be lit. So in other words, so Rashi is now Rashi tries to make all the pieces fit. So the candelabra, the menorah is supposed to burn continually, and this fire is supposed to burn continually, but if one goes, if they go out, what do you do, is basically the problem. And this fire is first, is what they're saying. The altar fire comes first, and then you use that fire to light the menorah fire, and then you keep them burning continuously. And not to go out. Anyone who puts it out violates two commandments, for verse 5 also said that it is not to go out. In other words, we have this issue that verse 5 and verse 6 say that the fire is not to go out. So if you do put it out, you violate two separate commandments. Again, Rashi's laying out step by step what the Torah is telling us. And then I want to turn the page to Ibn Ezra, because he speaks more to the point of the fire going continuously. The fire on the altar shall be burning. This repeats exactly the expression at the end of verse 2 in order to indicate that it is not to go out at any time during the day. So Ibn Ezra is letting us know that we say it twice. So it's saying not only is it not supposed to go out over the night, but all day long we're supposed to keep it burning. Every morning the priest shall feed wood to it, lay out the burnt offering on it, and turn into smoke the fat parts of the offering of well-being. We learn that the regular daily offering precedes whatever offerings of well-being may be brought that day. Great, we learned that from Rashi too. A perpetual fire should be kept burning. The kept burning phrase is repeated yet again to emphasize that the fire must be perpetual. This is not what I thought. All right, so I don't remember where it says it, but in one we learn that basically, oh, I now remember. I'm not going to tell, we'll read it in the source. Yes, sorry. So in basically we have other literature that develops the priesthood. That's basically how it functioned. There was even a guy whose special job it was to clear out the ashes, like every so often. And the priests would compete often to get these different roles in the temple and how it actually functioned. Yes, give me one second. I just want to see if it's worth reading this. No, we're going to go back. We're good. Yes?
What
does what? Say it again.
Translate to us.
Ah, my next transition. Excellent. So that's what we're going to start doing. So why have any of this at all now? Like, why do we want to read this? What are we supposed to learn from it if we don't have sacrifices anymore? And in fact, our eternal lights are electric. We don't have to feed them wood all of the time. We, in our Ner Tamid, actually have two light bulbs, if you look really carefully. One of them is a white light, which is actually a solar panel, is lit by a solar panel. Rabbi Sella, when he was here, figured that out. And the original light is also still lit, which is a more yellowish light. The light bulbs are very tiny, so you have to like really look carefully, but they're both there. Okay, so let's try and figure out what we want to do with it. Yes. To have two lights?
No.
Oh.
One from the solar.
Yeah.
And one from electric.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not what they're talking about. Ner Tamid. Ner Tamid is really a fire coming from wood.
100%. So since we're not actually doing sacrifices on it, basically, it was decided that it could be electric. Obviously, they didn't have electricity, 3,000 years ago when they were originally discussing this. And it's a new invention. But for the most part, people have decided it's the best way to keep the light burning, and it doesn't, since we're not actually doing sacrifices on it, having the light there is fine.
And it's okay with the rabbis?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Even in Orthodox schools, they have electric eternal lights. Yes?
Is the fire a symbol of light? What is it?
Great segue. All right. So now we're going to turn back to page 2. This time I mean it. And we're going to start. We're going to start to sort of pick it apart and see what we want to do with it. And then we'll read a couple of interpretations of what exactly this light is for us. Then we're going to look at some pictures. And in the last 2 minutes, last 3 or 4 minutes, we'll look at a very interesting drash and what it means that we're meant to be a kingdom of priests. God tells us that it's our job to be a kingdom of priests. Not of prophets, not of Torah scholars, not of spiritual people, but of priests. And Leviticus lays out exactly what priests do. So we're going to spend a little bit of a drash on what exactly it means to be a priest. But first, let's see what it means to us. So on page 2, I'll read the quote from the Torah, and then maybe we'll have different people read the interpretations. So, and the fire upon the altar shall be kept burning on it, and the priest shall burn wood on it every morning. So who wants to read from the Talmud? Please.
Although a fire descended from heaven upon the altar, it is a mitzvah to add to it a humanly produced fire.
So great. So we didn't read this section of Torah, but it seems that from the Torah that, in fact, God was a pillar of fire at night, that the original first lighting of the altar would be a divine fire, not just this. And in fact, that's probably where the Hanukkah story more or less comes from, that we have a tradition in the Book of Maccabees about this kind of thing happening. But we still have to do it. And so the Talmud is telling us, even though we have the fire there already, it's our job to add wood to it and keep it going or add some fire to it. And what does the Hasidic masters say? In Confessions, I took much of this from Chabad.org. They have great, if you look in their Parsha in-depth section, they have a sort of a column of different interpretations, which I think are often very interesting. All right, the Hasidic masters, who wants to read them? Please.
This is a rule that applies to all areas of life. The gifts of life are bestowed upon us from above. Yet it is God's desire that we add to them, the product of our own initiative.
So for those of you who've been coming, does this sound like anything else? So this is like a leading question. For those of you who've been coming a couple of weeks, who does it sound like? Well, we talked about this a little bit, just not like fire, yes?
It reminds me, you know, we're born into this world, but it is up to us to do what we want with life.
Great, excellent, 100%. So we have the choice to do with what we can, with what's in front of us. When we talked about Bezalel a couple of weeks ago, we talked about how it says in the Torah, God took the wise men and the people who had skill with crafts and gave them skill with crafts. Like if you take the people who are already good at something and tell them that that they're good at it, it's not like such an accomplishment. But the message the rabbis took from that is that we all have skills. We were all given talents in this world, and it's our job to try and use them for godly pursuits. So a similar message here. Yes.
I think there's another meaning that runs through the Torah, which is if you believe that God, that the fire is a gift of God from above, that's an act of faith. But you need to have, God wants us to act on top of faith. Faith alone is not enough. We must.
Excellent. So early on, when the temple is destroyed in the year 70 CE, after the destruction of the temple, we have this population of people who are the Israelites, and three groups of religious leaders are competing for them. The Karaites, who are a whole other thing, there's a couple of them still around in the world that I'm not going to spend it on, and the other eventually become the Christians and become the rabbis. The Christians choose that faith alone is what matters. That faith is what's most important, believing in God and eventually Jesus is what matters. And the Jews choose good works, that what you do is what matters. And it's evidenced here all the time. We hear it again and again. In fact, the rabbis debate, what's more important, study or action? So the rabbis give both answers, but the rationale for each answer is when the guy who says study is most important, says because study leads to action, and the guy who says action is most important is because action leads to study.
Yeah.
It's a very rabbinic answer. That, like, ultimately it's a cycle that you want them together, but still, action, action, action. We have to do something in this world to affect this world as it is. Great. So in the same verse again, and the fire upon the altar shall be kept burning on it, and the priest shall burn wood on it every morning. I don't know who the Al-Shikh is, but it's some commentator. Who wants to read what he says? The next one on the page, please. Yes.
There is a fire of love for God that burns within every soul. It is the task of the Kohen, the spiritual leaders of the generation, to feed and preserve this fire.
Great. So the perpetual fire, so our first sort of jump from it being an actual fire is that each of us have some sort of spark in God inside of us. And we don't know necessarily who the Kohanim are in our generation, but it's their job, whoever they are, the Kohanim.
Don't they have the last name of Kohen?
Right. So I don't mean the Kohanim. I mean the metaphorical Kohanim, who are the religious leaders, the people who are going to hold the souls of our people in their hands, and it's their job to try and feed the souls of others, to try and... So I know enough rabbis to know that it's not always the rabbis.
And I shouldn't be on a synagogue board because you get to know too much.
Right. You know, like sausage and laws. You know, the two things you don't want to know how they're made?
Right.
Maybe religious life also. Excellent. But regardless, there's an implication here that we need help from others to help feed our soul. Yes?
I was going to say, I kind of came with an interpretation. I just wanted to know what you thought of it.
Sure.
And since the fire descended from God, maybe it is God in a form that you're sacrificing to. And now that we can just pray to God and don't have to sacrifice, then it's saying to never let the fire go out in your heart, whether it's just praying. Don't just pray for beginning of the day and then go on with a life of sin, but to keep God on your mind.
I think that's absolutely, that is beautiful. Yes, that's certainly one way we want to take it. I've got 5 minutes. So the next page is more from Chabad.org, and they're great drashas. I encourage you to read them. I want to jump around a little bit. I want to look in the middle of page 4. Dr. Lisa Grant is, I think she's a professor at HUC, I'm blanking. It's from another website, which I also encourage you to frequent, called myjewishlearning.com. Myjewishlearning.com is just an outstanding resource, and it doesn't have it's a liberal site as opposed to Chabad, which is clearly not a liberal site, for those of you who know anything about Chabad. So if when you have both of them, you stand a reasonable chance of figuring out what's going on there. But I'll read small print, so I'll read what she has to say. This is actually taken from a commentary on Parsha Titzaveh, which came in Shmot, which is the place where we learn about the menorah. And we said the eternal light, maybe it comes from the menorah, maybe it comes from the altar, but it's the same idea, a constantly burning light. And it comes right before Purim. The Purim message that sometimes gets lost in all of the revelry is that a sense of God's presence in the world, even if hidden and obscure, gives us the strength and moral purpose to cope with uncertainties and imperfections. She's hinting at the fact that God's name isn't mentioned anywhere in the Megillah, but that belief in God, some sort of faith in God, can get us through the tough times when we're not sure how the world's going to turn out. Parsha Titzaveh paints a picture of the detail and exacting effort it took for the Israelites to feel God's presence in their midst. In other words, the building of the Mishkan. Today, we have no priests and no temple. The only vestige we have of this experience is the Ner Tamid, the eternal light, the first thing that God instructs Moses to establish in the opening verses of the parasha. This light has come to symbolize the light of Torah. For us, then, the glory and splendor of God's presence must be felt through the study of Torah and the constant striving to live in its light. So I think someone said that before. So another way to understand this is we don't have animals to sacrifice anymore. We have our time to sacrifice. We have ourselves to sacrifice, our personage. And we do that, the light, the flame that we want to give it over to, is study of Torah. And from that, we might feel lekarev, we might feel closer to God by giving ourselves over to study for Torah, which you all, I imagine, feel because you came on Thursday morning early to come study together. But, you know, it's fun to preach to the choir once in a while. Yes?
You know, talking about the light, it's so important even in modern life. Sometimes you're talking to a person and they are so, like, they have a tunnel vision that you see almost as if they tried to put out that light.
Excellent.
And then you talk to other people and they can see, like, the whole picture, like the light is there.
So sometimes I feel that the way I define maturity is that, like, the ever sort of growing vision, that you see more and more of the world, more and more, with more and more maturity. Like, that's what it means in some ways. And that means maybe try, that's another way of thinking about feeding that light, is trying to see more and more of what's around us. And that's what it means for us to put wood on the flame. Okay, now we're going to look at some, we have some debate on how to make Ner Tamid plural in Hebrew, so I'm just going to say Ner Tamids. I've got 4 of them here. And when I look at art, what I want to do is to ask ourselves, what's our reaction and what emotions does it make us feel? So here is our first one. It's like a shiny bronze metal bottom, maybe it's copper, I'm not sure, and red glass with letters.
I don't see the light.
Right, so it's hard to tell because it's an image. It resembles a flame, but I looked at it online. There's a light bulb in the middle that would be turned on. So it resembles an oil lamp. So we have a solid state of that sort of oil lamp. Excellent. So maybe the letters symbolize that we're feeding to it our study of Torah.
Right. Or maybe it's even something from Aseret HaDibrot.
Ah, so maybe it's the Ten Commandments?
Where is that from?
To be honest, I Google image searched Ner Tamid.
It's the Torah light that you're speaking of, it represents the Torah and the light.
Excellent. So it could be the Torah light. It represents Torah and light. Excellent. Beautiful. Do one more. So this is a big one. What? So there's a crown. There's a feeling like somehow this Ner Tamid is a crown. Is somehow the is royalty of some kind. This one is held outdoors. It's big. So like those are like floor to ceiling windows behind it. So it's a very large one.
Well, the knobs are
jewels on the crown.
Oh, just for decoration, right?
Yeah. My first thought when I saw it was one of the Torah crowns, actually. It feels like that, that somehow the Torah itself is from it rising up.
Yes.
Yeah, please.
My first thought was it looks like the flame on the top of the statue.
Oh, excellent. And maybe there's a connection there, like torch and light, that like they were, the people who made that were certainly, you know, steeped in biblical stuff. They weren't necessarily religious, but certainly knew their stuff there. Also, there's something about its massiveness that is that is eminent. It is that makes us feel it's unclear to me. There's actually a light inside, as opposed to just being an art installment. But I'm not actually sure there's light in the middle of it. I actually tried to find more information on this one because it was just so big and stunning, and I couldn't online. But I shared it anyway. Yeah, so, right, so inside there is a light bulb and it shines outwards. You can kind of see from the side. So we definitely see the menorah, so we're making reminiscence of that, yes?
The top one is a light?
I think that's just the cord that it's hanging from. I think the light's on the inside shining out.
Okay.
I brought this one mostly because it was different. I also felt the sort of box nature is something that's very like different, but important to realize that at times this is what people had as their Ner Tamid.
Yeah.
This one I just thought was stunning. See it from two different angles. This also is an artist's rendition. So what comes to mind from this one is clearly different. The leaves. Oh, it looks like a sukkah. Interesting. There's like a Sukkot theme which
really looks like a candle.
The center, because it looks like a candle because it's going up. Interesting. Yeah. Great. I also the tabernacle had two angels on it facing each other. And one of the ways we drash that is that we only can see God in relationship with someone else, that's where God comes through. And there's like a nice feeling of two things coming together here, and that's where the light comes out.
But that one has four, because on the other side it has two more.
Okay, so maybe it's four bearers. I saw two lights is more what I was thinking about.
Two sides, I see.
Yeah, two sides. But still, also a good point that maybe it's also, if there's four, then it becomes either a sukkah or maybe a chuppah.
Yeah.
Talking about our sort of the bridal relationship. The leaves, certainly. Did I have one more? Oh, I had another one.
Wow.
So, does anyone know what this is?
Is that in Israel?
I believe, I couldn't be sure, but I believe it's actually in Washington, D.C. What? Should give you a hint. At the end of the tour at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., this is the eternal light sort of burning there. Oh, beautiful. I didn't even think of that. So it's like a tree cut off. So we keep the light blowing. What? Yeah. That is wonderful. I've seen this like a dozen times. I've never thought of that.
Yeah.
And
it's also like in the shape of a tree cut out.
That's beautiful.
Is it letters or it's just the way?
I think it's just the way it's looking.
Oh, okay.
I don't think so. So the other thing I wanted to point out with this is that it's not above the ark is not the only place we use eternal light. We also heard that when we heard like the Statue of Liberty connection, that the concept of eternal light carries through different in different ways in which we do it, and it has to do often when things are darkest, when things are the toughest, are the hardest to manage. The two candles, if you've been to Yad Vashem in Israel, the children's memorial, the 1.5 million children who were killed in the Holocaust, is just two candles, but that are always kept burning, but with mirrors everywhere to make it look like 1.5 million lights. And in that way, we continue to try and think of light in the, as opposed to darkness. I thought I had one more. I must have decided not to. The other thing that many of them look like is you've probably seen it in movies, the censer, the smoke thing that Catholics use, that they sort of swing around. I don't know that much about it other than that it exists. But the art looks very similar often. So it's very likely that they went back and forth between the two cultures. Yes?
Sometimes we don't recognize the inevitable own myths. And I'd just like to call attention to Mickey Benoff's sculptures in our main sanctuary.
Yeah.
Which are reflective in the menorahs and the altar, which are from an artist here in our own community.
Well, you know the artist who did the Ner Tamid?
Yep.
Okay. Stay afterwards, I need to talk to you. You've been called to the principal's office. I've actually spent a while trying to figure out who would know about that, and we don't have it written down anywhere, so I would love to know a little more. Yeah. Great. What I want to conclude with in our last couple minutes is on the last page of the packet. It's from a book that you'll hear me quote every so often. It's called Torah, A Women's Commentary. And it basically takes the leading female biblical scholars, poets, spiritual leaders in the, I think, exclusively liberal Jewish world, conservative and reform. I don't know of anyone who, there is a rising female spiritual leader movement in modern Orthodoxy, but I think they're not a part of this project. And for every Parsha, it has its own line-by-line commentary. And it has a couple of very short essays before and after the Parsha and a collection of poems about the Parsha. I think it's a wonderful book. And it's there's always new to add to the Bible, but feminist scholarship is more new than most, so it's nice to get a really fresh perspective often on the Parsha. So we'll actually start on the bottom of the page where it says, for verse number 6, the priest keeps the sanctuary's fire going, perpetual fire, so we know that's what we've been talking about all morning. He takes care of the altar in the ways that homemakers, typically women, take care of the home. And then it says, go back and read the other thing I'm about to show you. So I was blown away at that thought process, that what it means to tend the fire is something that women do. So being told to be a nation of priests means that we're told to be a nation of God's homemakers, which fits so well in our metaphors and just twists lightly to make us women instead of men. So I think that in of itself is interesting. But let's read a little more in depth what she means by that. If human beings were gentle and benevolent by nature, we might not need the stern disciplinary teachings of the priesthood. The Torah's insight is that priestly service is what our homicidal proclivities demand and deserve. Homicidal proclivities. She's not mincing language here. That we, at some point, I'm willing to bet everyone in this room has had the sudden desire to do physical harm to someone else. It's just, it's part of human nature, that is the case. So, the descendants of Pinchas, a family whose origins are murderous and full of rage, are taught to direct their zealous energies to the service of God. Very shortly, Pinchas was a priest. He comes across a man, a Jewish man and a Midianite woman making love on the altar, basically, at the Mishkan, and he kills them both on the spot, spears them through, if you really want some, you know, imagery. Both with a spear, and God praises him, but Pinchas is the line of priests. That's where they come from. So there is this line. So this murderous tendency is then, those energies are redirected toward service of God. They turn from uncontrolled aggression to the discipline of ritual slaughter, hedged about with myriad laws and regulations. As officiants at the altar, their killing is tamed and domesticated. Their dangerous proclivities neutralized. Stripped of the normal male prerogatives of land ownership and military service, they become, as my teacher, Melilla Helner Eshed suggests, God's housewives. Feminized men who dress in skirts and busy themselves with domestic work of cooking and cleaning in God's holy dwelling. I wanted to, yes. Pinchas is one of Aaron's sons.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Oh, no, sorry, one of Eliezer's sons.
Anyway,
I'm almost positive that's
so
the case. He is Cohen. Now I'm not sure if he's Eliezer's brother or son. I'm blanking.
Yeah.
I don't know who she is. Okay. So I wanted to end with this drash because it's so different. And it really pushes us. My challenge, my response back, if I didn't like this drash, would be to say, it takes the great things women do, but say when you do those great things for God, it's men who have to do it. It's like a constant, like that's how it always works often. Like the head chef winds up being a man, but the woman who cooks at home is a woman. It's actually a way we play out these terrible stereotypes. But we can still use it to challenge it. That when God tells us not to be men, but a kingdom of priests, God tells us that it's our job to be God's homemaker, and this planet is the home. And the way that we tend the house is by trying to set ourselves strict regulations and rituals for which we might tend the world, for which we might sacrifice of ourselves to make the world better, to bring us closer to God. And I think that is a beautiful image that we may have never gotten to if we were not finally in an age where women commentators could be placed on the page alongside men, which Dafka, they're not in this book. It's just women commentators, but in many other books, they're placed right alongside men. So now let's hear some comments, and then we'll wrap up. Yeah. Ah, very well could be her. Most of the women who lead that group are Torah scholars in one way or another. So it's very likely. Yes. She was Midianite, which is like, that's how you know it's a priestly source. Because while we're talking about it, because who else was a Midianite?
Zipporah,
Moses' wife, the priestly source, spends, bashes her all the time, puts her down, hates that Moses was married to a non-Jew, and so finds every possible opportunity to make it seem that that is an exception. It's not okay generally. It was a one-time situation. Moses is different from everyone else. The priestly source often elevates Moses to a higher than regular person status, as if to say whatever Moses does is not a model for the rest of us. The priests are the leaders. But yes, sorry. That was
Well,
she converts. Ruth is the model for conversion. When the rabbis understand that when Ruth, when everyone dies and Ruth and Naomi are coming back, Ruth says, I'll come back to your land, your God will be my God. And at that moment, she becomes a Jew. Yeah. She's considered maybe the first convert. Jethro is debatably the other one. Yes. I cut you off in the middle of your question. Did you have a question more? No. Yeah.
Talking about the humility of Moses taking out the ashes.
Yeah.
Right,
so I mean, that's why we have multiple sources in the Bible, that like they mesh together to give us lots of different...
Nice.
Yeah. The what, sorry?
I just think that was a very nice evidence of his humility.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.
I wonder whether Janet Martin married. I don't know who she is.
I don't know her either. I just...
But, you know, the opening line of human beings are gentle, benevolent. I read it. She read Thomas Hobbes. This is the exact opposite of Hobbes, who says man is born nasty, ugly, mean, and brutish. And in order to have a society, you need kings and power and dictatorship and authority to run your life.
Well, the conclusion, the premise is the same. The conclusion is the opposite.
But the theocracy that they wanted was a pretty tough theocracy. It wasn't democracy. It wasn't an open society. It was, you do it my way or your own.
It's true. Excellent. And with that, we'll end. A reminder that we don't have class next week. We'll begin after Passover, the Thursday after. What? 2 weeks from now. Yeah, 2 weeks from now. So skipping one session. We rise now for Kaddish DeRabbanan.